Are you ready to begin?
Yes, I'm all set here.
Any program about science or scientists today is almost bound to focus on space.
Okay, Houston, the Challenger has landed.
Houston Station, we are ready for the event. Thank you.
Hello, welcome to the Space Boffins podcast. I'm Richard Hollingham, and I'm joined by Sue Nelson for the first of our monthly podcasts covering space from a UK perspective. Although, if you're elsewhere, you are very welcome. Now, we're both science journalists and have reported on space and made radio programmes on space. But more importantly, we are space fans, and we hope we can get across our enthusiasm for space in these podcasts. We're going to cover everything from, I don't know, astronauts to satellites, alien moons to space stations. And here's the mission statement. You don't need a degree in physics to listen. Just an interest in space. Although, as it happens, Sue does have a degree in physics. So, Sue, what's the plan for the first edition?
Well, as this month marks the end of the space shuttle program, assuming that Atlantis launches as planned, we'll be talking about the legacy of the space shuttle and its possible replacement, including the British space plane Skylon. We'll also be discussing the International Space Station. And to do that, we're joined by David Parker, Director of Science, Technology and Exploration for the UK Space Agency, and recently appointed as the European Space Agency's Chair of Human Spaceflight, Microgravity and Exploration Programme Board. That's a fantastic title, David. What does it mean?
Well, it means every few months, all of the different countries that are involved in these programmes with the European Space Agency get together and discuss the projects and the programmes, and I get to chair that meeting.
Fantastic.
Also with us is Jonathan Amos, BBC science correspondent and space expert, who until recently blogged as Spaceman. Why are you no longer Spaceman?
That's a good question. And I had a fabulous picture as well. If people followed the blog, they could see, well, my mug, but more importantly, they could see one of the shuttles over my shoulder, which I thought was a fantastic picture. But in the BBC now, like every magazine, Hello and OK and all the rest of it, I think they're pushing personalities and
You're saying you've got no personality,
well,
Jonathan.
They want to push the name. They think I'm sufficiently famous now that they want to say, Jonathan Amos, and so there you go. That's what they do, and I get a brand new picture. But sadly, I've lost my shuttle.
It makes you look like a private detective or something.
Yeah, that was the one picture we could use out of a very long reel.
Well, let's talk about the space shuttle. And since its first flight in April 1981, it's launched satellites, people, and even worms into space. It's also proved to be extremely dangerous, with the loss of Challenger and her crew in 1986 and Columbia in 2003. Still, it does rather feel, doesn't it, like the end of an era. Well, I met a fellow space enthusiast recently, science broadcaster Kate Arklas-Gray, who blogs as Space Kate. She's on a mission to fly in space. She says ideally by the time she's 40, which just makes the rest of us feel very old. In the meantime, she's been getting as close as she can to anything space-related. Well, Kate was chosen for the NASA tweet-up and joined other Tweety people at the press site at Cape Canaveral for the recent launch of Discovery.
She was our shuttle, Diva Discovery. You know, would she go? And we all were hoping and wishing, and everything looked great.
Come on, girl.
It was just the most amazing thing. We were just screaming and shouting as she started to go, and then of course you're 3 miles away, so it takes longer for the sound to hit you, so we were all cheering, and then you can just hear it kind of dying down slightly, so this very low rumble starts coming across the water at you, and it gets louder and louder, and it's like thousands of fireworks going off at once. It's like the sound is ripping through the air. You know, if you listen to the recordings, you might think that the microphone was having some problems because it was so noisy. No, it actually sounds like that crazy kind of popping. Yeah, it's like a mad noise you can't describe, but it wasn't just the noise, it was the feel of it. You feel the thrust of those engines and those rocket boosters. You can feel it in your chest. You know, everything was vibrating, everything shook, and we just went silent. Everyone just kind of was in their own little place. Just, wow. And then, you know, as the sound starts to die away again, we all cheered, and I just can't explain it.
Why do you think it's got that emotional response? Is it because people are on board?
I think because there were people on board. I think because the shuttle is an iconic thing. It's like one of those huge brands. Everybody knows Coca-Cola around the world. Everybody knows NASA. So there's something exciting. These are the people that put men on the moon. There was actually a member in our group who knew one of the astronauts on board. And my feelings changed about the shuttle launch after I watched on the NASA TV, I watched the Soyuz launch, which launched ESA astronaut Paolo Nespoli, an Italian guy that I'd actually met and had dinner with. Suddenly, there was a big rocket with lots and lots of rocket fuel, and my friend was sitting on top of it. And suddenly, it's not just an astronaut. You suddenly go, oh, these are real people. And this is really dangerous. And there was a moment where we all just kind of froze and thought it would just be so horrific to witness something if it went wrong. I was an absolute wreck watching Paolo go up. I mean, even worse because they have live cameras pointing at their faces. And I just thought, oh, I can't. You know, I thought, you know, I've met this guy twice. What's it like for the families? Your wife is on the shuttle or your dad is... Oh, I just.
Do you think we'll miss it when it's gone?
I will miss it. I wonder if the general public will. I think they will. It's not quite Apollo moon landing stuff, but it is an iconic vehicle. I mean, it's a beautiful thing to look at. I mean, never mind the fact it flies into space. It's just a beautiful piece of aviation. It's lovely. I like it. I think it's going to have a huge effect on Florida and Houston. I mean, I already know people that are selling up their houses. You know, they've taken voluntary redundancy or they've already got the push and they've got to find something new to do. And what do? You've grown up around the area. You've gone into space because that's what everybody does. And now the thing that sort of kept you there, kept you busy, kept you employed, well, it's not going to be there anymore. So what do you do next? What will happen to Florida? I don't know.
Kate Arkless Gray. Do look at her blog. You'll also find Kate on Audioboo. Just search for Space Kate. OK, here's the challenge, guys. Name the space shuttles.
Well, all of them.
Yeah, all of them.
From the very beginning.
Yeah. You can't look at my... OK, Enterprise, yeah.
OK, do I have to get them in order?
No. You can just
Discovery.
Yeah.
All right. Columbia.
Yeah.
Atlantis.
Yeah.
Challenger.
Yeah, and Endeavour.
Well
very
done.
Good. Yeah, and you got Enterprise in as well, which
yeah,
was
no,
the...
No, you mustn't forget no, Enterprise.
The prototype.
Yeah. In fact, we've actually seen Enterprise because it's at the NASA Space Museum just outside Dulles Airport. That's and right. I actually felt more thrilled about that than anything else. I don't know why, because I've never seen a shuttle launch. But have the two of you seen shuttle launches?
Yeah, I've been lucky enough to see quite a few, and I've seen daylight and nighttime as well. I can't quite make my mind up which is better, day or night. Nighttime, everything goes orange. This extraordinary orange glow just sort of goes into every corner. But the thing that really strikes you when you think, people say, oh, it's going to be really loud, really loud. And you think, OK, right, I'm prepared for this. And the first thing you notice is just how bright it is. It's like a star lifting up off the ground. You think,
but it's
whoa.
That gap as well, because yes. Richard and I were at an Ariane 4 launch in 1999. And what stunned us was the fact that for several seconds, the rocket is lifting. You're seeing the light, but you're hearing nothing. Mm. Yeah. Because, and that's the thing that a night launch gives you, is that delay between the light and the sound.
Yeah, well, I haven't seen a shuttle launch, but I went to see my first Ariane launch in French Guiana last year, and exactly the same thing. It was the brightness of the light as the Ariane 5 came over the horizon. And it was really lucky because it was a perfect blue sky kind of a day. So we were able to follow the rocket all the way up to the point where the solid boosters came off it. So it was a really amazing sight.
Do you feel an emotional response, particularly when you see a rocket with people on board?
Yeah, I mean, I do. I went to school in Filton at the end of the runway in Bristol. And when I played football on the playing fields, Concorde used to come over to do its test flights prior to going into commercial service. And, you know, when they retired Concorde, I had a huge lump in my throat. I really did. I got the sensation that somehow we were stepping back. And I kind of feel the same way about shuttle as well. I know it's now a flawed design. I think everybody accepts that. And you know, for some of the things that we want to do, i.e. to go beyond low Earth orbit, it's not appropriate technology anyway. But nonetheless, you kind of felt it meant something. It went somewhere. It did something. And we're just left in this position at the moment where we're not quite sure where we're going.
Dave, it has been described as more a dead end, that they shouldn't have done the shuttle, should have gone on from the moon to do other more ambitious things?
Well, that's one way of looking at it. I mean, the dream of the shuttle was to be able to use it as a space truck to go up there and come back down on once a week or something. And as John says, I was at just about to go to university to study at astronautics on the time of the first shuttle launch, and it seemed like the future. And for a few years, it really was. I mean, it was being used for everything. But, yeah, with looking back in time, perhaps if we carried on with those big dumb rockets, we might have got to Mars by now. Who knows?
Go on to these big dumb rockets. That's exactly what people are now going for, isn't it?
It is. I've just got to tell you my shuttle story.
Okay.
So I was out for one launch. I can't remember which one it was. And I got a call from BBC World, the sort of foreign news channel that the BBC runs, saying, can you do a live commentary? And I thought, oh, no, I don't really want to do this. I want to stand outside, watch it, feel it, all the rest of it. So I said, OK, right. Well, I needed a point in which to, you know, do the live commentary from. So I went to some friends in Reuters who have a little booth up on the hill there, the press knoll. And so I did it from there, plugged in. You know, I was talking right up to the moment of launch. And I said to the other presenter, I said, look, I'm going to step outside the booth now. You won't be able to hear me anyway, so I'm just going to shut up. And while I shut up, I'm going to step out. So I stepped outside the booth and I hung on to the door, thinking I was just about to go back in and pick up the commentary after it had, you know, gone through the clouds. And of course, this enormous roar. And then the air shakes. I mean, everything about it just vibrates. When it goes, all the alarms in the cars in the car park, they all go off together. And my hand is shaking on this door, and it shuts. And then I'm going like this with the door handle, trying to open the door to get back on air, and I can't. So then I'm hammering on the door, and eventually one of the Reuters correspondents opens up for me, and I'm able to get in and cough on the line, and they say, and Jonathan, what did it look like from Cape Canaveral?
David, with the space shuttle, though, did we get much British science at all on the shuttle?
Gosh, yes. I mean, most fundamentally, because the Hubble Space Telescope was launched by the space shuttle.
So as a launcher, but not actually,
I mean,
on board?
On board.
Well, as I said, primarily it was a space truck. It was designed to take stuff up there and bring it back again. So it's been used to build the International Space Station, used to launch, for example, the Ulysses mission that went all the way out to the solar poles. Fantastic mission, operated for years. But look, Hubble Space Telescope, the UK is the second largest user of Hubble over the years. And each time the Hubble has been serviced by a space station, it's got better and better. And the results keep flowing. I mean, the amount of science that's done with Hubble is extraordinary.
I mean, that's the problem with going back to the rockets, that you can't do servicing missions. You can no longer go up there and fix something that's in orbit. I mean, we would have been stuffed with Hubble if you couldn't do that.
Well, absolutely. If people remember back, it was discovered after Hubble was launched that there was a tiny but absolutely fundamental flaw in the optics, which meant the pictures were out of focus. So without the ability to go back and service it, we would have been sunk, and all of that science wouldn't have happened, and all those amazing images that have become really iconic, we wouldn't have had them.
Is your question that did we build any of it? Should we have built? I mean, there were discussions right at the very beginning about involving European industry in the construction of the shuttle. And I think it was Hawker Siddeley were looking at plans to do, I think it may have been the nose cone, the payload bay doors, some of the undercarriage. That was a serious discussion, and then everything got taken back into the United States and done in-house, so to speak. But in the very early days, there were discussions about it being a multinational construction effort.
Can I come back to these big dumb rockets? Because if we're going to move on from the shuttle, this is what we're going to. I was at a conference on space insurance, of all things, just before Easter, and the real buzz from the NASA guys there was about SpaceX. Uh-huh. This space startup, which is essentially building rockets with capsules at the top. Mm. Is that what we're going back to? Mm.
Well, maybe it is, maybe for the time being. I mean, SpaceX, it's set up by this guy, Elon Musk, who made his fortune out of PayPal. Some of you may have used that. And he obviously is an enthusiast like the rest of us and decided had the money to go and start building some rockets himself. And he's had several launches and these Falcons, and they're doing the job, but NASA are going to start buying them effectively to service the space station, and maybe when those capsules are working, to send astronauts up to the space station and back again.
Is this the end, John, of the big space agency doing big things, big projects?
Well, that's a difficult one. I mean, I think the thing about SpaceX, what they've changed is the cost paradigm. Take Ariane for an example here in Europe, and you know, Dave probably knows this better because he may well have seen some of the books that have come through through ESA, so he knows what the real costs are. But you know, in Europe, the way that we make rockets, we have an inbuilt cost. I call it the cost of community, whereby it's seen as a European grand project, which means that everybody gets to build a little bit of something so that they feel a part of it. Well, at SpaceX, it's completely the opposite. They do everything, virtually everything, in-house, which means that you don't build one segment, put it on a truck, drive it across the border into France, do something else, then put it on another truck and then drive it into Switzerland, which makes it colossally expensive. Mm. Now, in SpaceX, they do the motors, they do the structure, they do the capsule. Everything is done in one rocket road in California, in LA, where they're based. And that's how they're able to keep costs down.
Yeah, have you seen the books for Ariane Space?
I've not seen the books, but what I know is that Ariane is challenged to keep itself competitive against all the other suppliers, and no doubt SpaceX is going to be quite a challenge to them.
What a diplomatic answer.
Yes, I was
okay, well, there's also, we haven't mentioned it yet, Skylon.
That's right. And for those of you who don't know where it's based, it's pretty amazing. It's a former airfield in Oxfordshire. It's now some sort of techno base for all sorts of different companies. It's called the Cullum Science Centre. And one of those companies, Reaction Engines Limited, is behind the designs for a reusable space plane. And unlike the shuttle, have no astronauts on board. And unlike that sort of fat, chunky, barrel-like shuttle. Oh, this is gorgeous. More like Concorde in shape. Sleek, black, almost 1950s sort of sci-fi rocket style. It's called Skylon. Recently passed an important technical assessment. It was commissioned by the UK Space Agency, undertaken by experts at ESA. And I went to Cullum to meet one of the driving forces of the company. Yes, I'm talking about Alan Bond.
Skylon's very different to the sort of rockets that you normally see, in that it's really a very powerful aeroplane, and it's a return to the sort of challenges that people were facing in the 1950s and 60s, where it was generally assumed that we would fly higher and faster until one day we found ourselves in orbit. Existing rockets, as you know, get assembled at the launch site. Very complex operation, taking a lot of people, quite a long time. All those bits then get thrown away as the vehicle goes to orbit, and then when it's delivered its payload, nothing returns. So you throw away the transport system every time with a conventional rocket. With Skylon, once it's done its job, it re-enters, flies back like a glider, lands, and then 2 days later you can do it all again.
And what makes this possible?
There's several things that actually conspire to make it possible, but the really important central factor is its new engine. Over many years now, we've been working to develop an engine which is a combination of the good old-fashioned jet engine, which is supported as well, and, of course, the rocket engine, which is supported as equally well. And if you put those two together, it's not quite as simple as I make it sound, but you put them together correctly, you can then achieve this technological miracle of getting the aeroplane into orbit and back again.
It's called SABRE, standing for Synergetic Air-Breathing Rocket Engine. Obviously, there's a major clue into how it works from the title itself, air-breathing.
Yes. Conventional rocket engines are almost good enough to get us into space in one shot on their own, but not quite. The Earth's about 10% too big, as one of my colleagues keeps reminding me. So you need a bit of a leg up for the first sort of Mach 5 or so of the trip to orbit. So by building something which is like a jet engine, which uses the air, but which can accelerate to 5 times the speed of sound, that is sufficient help that the rocket can then do the rest all on its own. But of course, that's quite a trick. An ordinary jet engine can't get really much above 2¾ of the speed of sound. So what we have to do is to cleverly engineer it so that the liquid hydrogen fuel on board can cool the incoming air and help us to get that extra little bit up to Mach 5 or just beyond, so that the rocket can then take over.
It's not as straightforward as that, though, is it? Because the incoming air is at an extremely high speed, and that takes the temperature up to extremely high levels.
Yes. I mean, the air is coming into the engine at about 1.5 kilometres a second. You decelerate that, and all the kinetic energy in the air gets turned into heat, so the temperature shoots up to something over 1,000 degrees centigrade. Then you'd like to be able to compress the air to get it into the same combustion chamber that the rocket uses. But of course, it's already so hot, and as you know, when you compress air, it gets even hotter, You can't do it. So the first thing you've got to do is to cool the air. In the Sabre engines, it goes down to minus 140 degrees C before we actually start compressing it to put it in the rocket engines. And that's the trick, using the hydrogen fuel to cool the air so that you can compress it to put it into the same combustion system that the rocket will then use later on.
And this is where you need a heat exchanger.
That's absolutely right, and the heat exchangers that we're looking at are very impressive by anyone's standards.
You've passed this technical review, a big vote of confidence there. Where do you go from here?
We've built a plant in Abingdon in which we manufacture the heat exchanger components. So we've had to show that we can make those, and that we've been successful at. So the next step is to build a heat exchanger using that plant and then put that on test in front of an engine in order to generate the information that we need to then go on and design the real Sabre engines later.
In terms of finances, you've had some government funding, you've also got private investment. How do you see that progressing?
85% of what we've spent so far has been private investment.
Was that a deliberate decision? Do you want to keep government out?
There was a time when anybody's money would have been good enough, but of late we're now satisfied that this is a commercial development. We're not asking the government for any money at all for the further development of the vehicle.
Alan Bond from Skylon, ending on a sentiment that I suspect the UK Space Agency's David Parker is probably delighted to hear, as the next stage will cost around £200 million. Skylon aims to go on the production line in 2018 and will be in service, well, that's the aim, in, at least from 2020 onwards.
Jonathan, you've been covering this stuff for a long time. Do you think Skylon will go anywhere?
Just to say, first of all, that ESA assessment that the UK Space Agency asked to be performed, I thought was very important because, you know, ESA could have almost binned that project there and then. If they'd come back with something and said, you know what, we don't think this is going to work.
They did more than that, though,
they
didn't they?
They came
back and said,
they're no showstoppers.
If this goes ahead, it's a technological sort of innovation.
Yes, indeed. So they didn't look at everything, it has to be said, but the key parts they did look, they found no showstoppers, and that was very, very important. One of the things to remember is that great innovations don't always fail technically. They fail financially, they fail regulatory. And it may well be that what scuppers Skylon in the end, if that's what happens, it may not be a technical issue. It may be something else. If you remember, go back to Concorde again. You remember the difficulty that Concorde initially had flying into the United States.
Well, Alan Bond did say that actually where the British government was helping, and this is probably where the UK Space Agency comes in, is in doing all this groundwork, all this unseen work, making the regulatory framework so that they can go ahead.
We've been working with Alan Bond and his team for quite a while now. First of all, to help secure some of the money that we have provided to get this first stage going, and to involve the European Space Agency and involve their experts in the technical review. But yes, you're right. The regulatory issue is, well, nobody's built a Mach 5 robotic plane to fly through the atmosphere. How do you handle that? How do you handle that from an insurance point of view? But it's a really exciting technology, a really big step forward. You know, somebody said to me, it's perhaps the biggest step forward in propulsion since Frank Whittle invented the jet engine. That's hyperbole, maybe, might be right.
It would be fantastic. Well, the shuttle may be gone, but one of the reasons it was built in the first place is still there. A giant orbiting space station. Well, here's the original NASA promotional video I dug out for the International Space Station.
Soon, I'll be able to look into the night sky and see our work up there with the Big Dipper, the moon, and the stars.
I got to see a man walk on the moon. My kids deserve to see something as inspiring.
Really, the International Space Station, as inspiring as putting men on the moon. It's fair to say, I think, the International Space Station has had its critics over the years. It's worth saying also that the UK stands apart from its European colleagues in not putting money into the project. Now, I remember, David, one of your predecessors, who I won't name, described the International Space Station when I was covering its launch in the 1990s as an orbiting white elephant. Do you share that view?
It's kind of a strong statement to make. I mean, the engineering...
He's needless to say no longer working for the UK Space Agency.
Well, look, the engineer in me thinks it is the most amazing construction project that has ever been achieved by humankind.
That's like damning with faint praise, though, isn't it?
The question is, what is it for? The answer to that we'll only discover over the next few years as it starts to be used as a scientific laboratory. And so the fair way to evaluate it is what is the quality of the science that now comes out of it now that it's up there and operating. If you like, the criticism is that what the astronauts spend a lot of their time doing is fixing the bits that are breaking down on the space station.
Well, it has been called the flying larder, hasn't it?
Is that right?
Yeah, yes.
Isn't that? I thought that's praiseworthy.
Yes.
Yeah, they're a good car. I mean, that's the point, isn't it, Jonathan? That there have been no papers, as far as I can tell, in major journals as a result of science on the space station.
Yes, it's finished now, and they have to show something. But, you know, I have to say, most of the science that will come out of the space station, I'm talking about microgravity research now, it's unsung science in many ways. You need to understand how liquids move, how fluids move, all of that kind of stuff to make other discoveries doing other stuff. But there are possibly one or two eureka moments on the space station to come. One of them concerns the big particle physics detector, which has gone up, which potentially could make some really exciting discoveries.
That was on the last shuttle launch.
That's right, yeah. About dark matter, antimatter, that kind of thing. There's some very interesting vaccine research going on at the moment. One of the agents they're looking at is MRSA, this hospital-borne infection. Now, if they were to find a vaccine for that, the space station pays for itself overnight.
Dave, could the UK now get on board, if you like, the International Space Station? I don't mean necessarily having an astronaut on board, but backing the science that's going on board, because the UK has taken very much a back seat on this, hasn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, we had a workshop quite recently where we got a range of different scientists who are interested in doing science on the space station and in a microgravity environment in general together to find where might be the sweet spots, where there might be some really interesting areas of science to be done.
And are you coming at that from a science perspective, or are you coming at that from a political perspective, because it wouldn't be nice if the UK was involved?
Oh, I think it's got to be excellent science.
What about Tim Peake? You know, we have this British astronaut unveiled to great acclaim. He's very media friendly, but will he ever actually get up there? Particularly now there's no shuttle and we're reliant on the Soyuz in French Guiana.
Well, it's a question for all of the future ESA astronauts is exactly what their opportunities are going to be to fly. But I think they'll all get there in time. But actually, we've had some really good conversations with Tim, and we're involving him in working with some of the science areas. And what I was going to say is some of the sweet spots might be in medical sciences. You've got the classic example that bone loss in zero G. Some of it is analogous to what happens to elderly people.
But isn't this science that has been known about since Yuri Gagarin?
The fact that it happens is has been known for a long time, but understanding the actual biology behind it, no, I don't think it's cracked at all.
So the point about the space station is that you can do the experiment, repeat it, repeat it again, repeat it again, change the parameters slightly, repeat it. That's how you do science. That's how you do science in a laboratory on Earth. That's how you really get to understand how systems work. And the only way you can get at microgravity research on that sort of level is to do it on the space station.
I'd like to get on before we finish onto the new UK Space Agency, which came into being in April. Your employer, David. Mm. What will it do?
What it will do is, first of all, run the programmes that we already have with the European Space Agency and nationally. So we're building scientific instruments that will fly in James Webb Space Telescope. We'll be involved in a rover to go to Mars and so forth. Those are the projects, if you like. But really what we're here to do is to make our space industry grow. And this is the key thing, that we spend a few hundred million of government money, but the space industry is worth £7.5 billion to the UK economy.
So that was the thing that worried me, flicking through the strategy, or this draft strategy. It's all about growth and economics and getting more money back than you've put.
It sounds more like a business proposal.
Yeah. It does kind of matter if you look at what's going on around the economy in general at the moment. It's the UK or anywhere else in Europe. What matters is, if we're going to pay for the future space programme, is to show that it actually returns something to the economy. And it does. The story is positive.
Can you do that while still having the aspiration and the excitement about space?
I think it's two sides of the same coin. Some of the exciting things we are doing are also going to bring real economic results. You know, we're involved in this Aurora program, Mars exploration, build a rover, all the rest of it. But some early technology work that was done in a company up in the East Midlands, that is going to develop some control technology. Sounds really boring. What might the benefit be? Well, they think they can reduce the amount of aluminium that's used in a Coke can by 10%. Imagine how much that is going to save in terms of raw materials. So environmental impact from going to Mars.
Thank you very much to Dave Parker and Jonathan Amos. That is the first Space Boffins podcast. There'll be a new one in a month's time. If you like it, do spread the word. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Just search for Space Boffins. The Space Boffins podcast is a Boffin Media production. I'm Richard Hollingham.
And I'm Sue Nelson. Thanks for listening.